warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time. In these episodes, we shall be discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really significant in the exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's guests, I should mention that this program is being recorded on location, so if you do hear a few background noises, you'll know why. Helping us in our explorations today are Professor Anthony Frendor, Emeritus Professor of Near Eastern Archaeology and the Hebrew Bible, and Senior Fellow within the Department of Oriental Studies and the Department of Classics and Archaeology at the University of Malta. And with him is Dr. Dennis Mitzi, Senior Lecturer and Head of the University's Department of Oriental Studies. Welcome and thank you both for accepting to come on the programme and talk to us about Bible and archaeology, the dialogue between the two, and the importance of that conversation within the field of archaeology. So I'm going to go straight in with my first query. Really, why should biblical scholars take archaeology seriously?
Well, I think, first of all, every artifact, and even the Bible is an artifact, all right, it's a religious artifact, if you take it as from the religious point of view, has to be taken in its own context. And the biblical world, which stretches for about over 1,000 years, if we combine both the so-called Old and New Testaments, is in a context, a historical context of the ancient Near East, a historical context of the Hellenistic world, and that of the Roman Empire, if we come further down in time. So that's the first point. And archaeology helps us to decipher things like social context, culture, why people do things, how they interact, and so on. But then there's another reason, because at times the archaeology of the Levant, right, and this restricting a bit the field now, that is to say of the eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean, basically, helps us even to unlock some very strange texts. For example, in the Hebrew Bible, there is a text, at least once this happens, when we are told that a latrine, a cesspit, was laid over a temple to desacralize it. What's this all about, really? Well, the idea was to not let that particular temple function anymore. Is this fiction? Is this historically, socially true? It is, because in a temple in Lachish, such a situation was found. A toilet placed over a temple which was no longer to be used because of a religious reform there should be no temples outside Jerusalem.
Yes, and if we're studying the ancient world, right, we have to make use of all the evidence. So it doesn't make sense to limit ourselves to the textual evidence when I have all this material culture, which is part and parcel, you know, it's the product of the same people who wrote our texts. In particular, I think the reason why also biblical scholars should take archaeology seriously is that the texts themselves, there are limits to them. They tell us a lot of things, but at the same time, they are really giving us the point of view of, let's say, 5 to 10% of the population, which is the elite segment of the population, that segment that had the time and resources to study and write. And so the ideas that we find in the biblical texts are really a limited set of ideas of a limited segment of the population. What did the 90% of the rest of the population did? What did they believe? We don't know that. Because, I mean, okay, we can assume that perhaps the texts do represent some of, also sort of like some of the ideas and beliefs of the wider population, but surely not all of the population. So the texts are limited in that sense. The texts are also biased, so there might have been other alternative views which were put down in writing, but which were not preserved. Why do we have the texts that we have? It's because someone decided that they are worth preserving. There must have been other texts that are that someone decided they were not worth preserving. So the texts, in a nutshell, are biased. They are limited. And archaeology gives us sort of like an opportunity to explore the daily lives, the ideas, beliefs, practices of other people that may not be represented in these texts. And in this sense, archaeology is, for lack of a better word, more objective, you know, but of course there are it has its limitations, you know, because artifacts are in a sense mute, they have to be interpreted, and this is why then also archaeologists disagree about how to interpret these artifacts. But yeah, you cannot study the a society, the ancient world, without if you ignore archaeology.
And I think also a privileged archaeological artifact, which often we forget is archaeology, are inscriptions, because they give often the viewpoint of not the elite, and yet they are written evidence and they bridge. And the other thing is that archaeology obviously spans a long range view, the long durée, whereas the texts, in this case the biblical texts, are more, let's say, focused on a person or a period. So they go hand in hand. They are the catalyst of what we would know. In other words, we might know that something is happening at the end of the late Bronze Age in Canaan, something really strange, and the texts give us a catalyst, a person. But it's not saying the whole story. Both together, they give us a more holistic approach, I think, as Dennis said.
Yeah, exactly. And also, there, beyond the question of bias, there's also the question of interest, in the sense that many of our texts, the biblical texts, are interested in narrating a story and presenting a certain theological or ideological argument. They may not be, their interest is not to describe the socioeconomic conditions. You know, I mean, we can reconstruct them by reading between the lines, but the point is, you know, sort of like, so archaeology, for example, in this case, allows us to reconstruct in more detail the social reality, the economies, the industries, trade. These are not these were not the interests of our authors, although they assume them, and we can reconstruct them indirectly by sort of like. But you know, archaeology gives us more direct evidence, so and the two balance each other.
In this context, it's interesting to remember that the Bible is not a history book. It contains historical information, but nuggets, so to say, and therefore that makes a bit of a difference. They have to go hand in hand, I think.
This subject takes me out of my comfort zone, so if I say something which is really basic, please forgive me. But when we're talking about the texts, how far back do we know they go? I mean, is there a date for them? Do they write about things that were in the past?
You mean the biblical texts? Well, the biblical texts, as usual, not everybody agrees when we go to the older period. The earliest possible biblical texts, we have copies, by the way, we don't have the original autographs. The earliest, when we assume the original autograph was written, would be 1200. But nowadays, it tends to be more like the 9th, 8th century BC, when there was more literacy in Jude, Israel, and so on. The other thing is that so that's when we start. Let's say we start at 800 BC, and then it comes down. But it's important to remember we don't have autographs, not a comma. We have copies and copies of copies. And then it's up to the scholar to weigh and balance which would be the more probable original one.
And many of these texts also, they have a long history of composition and development. So sometimes what we call a book is really the conflation, diffusion of pre-existing works, you know, multiple works that an editor decided to bring together to create a new work out of them. So we have the history of the work itself as it survives today. Like, we can say this was edited, you know, sometime, for example, in the 6th century. But then the sources that make up that book would predate it by several centuries.
Exactly.
So you have to make that distinction as well.
And what you said is important. It's if there are events behind the text, or when there are, because there are certain events, the texts were written later, not contemporaneous. That's another problem which scholars have to take into account, you know, but it's a fascinating story.
But perhaps an important point in this, like a pivotal event that really is a fulcrum for, like, in a way, I could say that the Hebrew Bible, you know, the Old Testament might not exist if it weren't for this pivotal event would be the Babylonian exile. That's sort of like it was really sort of like a catastrophic, devastating event that sort of like led to a lot of theological and
rethinking.
And it was in many ways one of the catalysts for the editing of the books of the Bible as we have them today.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that the sources did not exist, but the catalyst for bringing these sources together in such a way as we have them today was very much the Babylonian
exactly.
exile.
And what Dennis has just said is true. For example, let's say the book of Numbers is a late composition, although traditions could be earlier. And this latter point is proven by, there is a so-called blessing of Aaron, a small text, may the God of Yahweh, the God of Israel, bless you, shine upon you, which was found on a silver amulet dating before the exile. But the text, which is literary and not the archaeological artifact, was composed and edited later.
It's quite a conundrum when you're looking at it like that. So how can we bring the Bible and archaeology then into conversation? How do we actually manage to sort of correlate them?
I think the main point is that we recognize that they are two separate individual disciplines, each with their own methods. Well, as many people know, archaeology has got its own methods. It's a developed discipline nowadays. It makes use even of science. It has to be excavations to be well conducted, stratigraphic excavation, and so on. Reports have to be written well. The evidence has to be presented very clearly, as independently as possible of the theories of the excavator, as much as is possible, distinguishing as much as is possible data from interpretation, and so on. On the other hand, the Bible too is a discipline, if you take it from the scholarly point of view, a discipline in its own merits. You've got to take into consideration knowledge of the original languages, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. You've got to take into consideration what Dennis mentioned, the literary composition of a text, the history of a text, the strata of a text, the fact that we don't have the original autographs, therefore leads us to decide which was the more probable, likely one which the author wrote, and so on. So there's two separate disciplines, and it's like two people in a marriage. They are individual persons, and they can marry later on, but they still retain their personality.
Yeah. And I think one of the important things also is, and I think this has been, or it remains to an extent, a problem in the field, is that people approach this question with, you know, either trying to prove, you know, like trying to say, okay, archaeology proves the Bible, or else, you know, no, archaeology disproves the Bible. So sort of like they approach this question with the intention to either prove or disprove the Bible by comparing the two together. And I think this is sometimes misses the point, because what we should be doing when we bring these two separate bodies of evidence into conversation with each other is not to try to necessarily find a correspondence or lack thereof between them, but rather to explore if there are contradictions between the sources. This is where things become interesting. What do these contradictions entail? Does it mean that one source is false or it's incorrect? It allows us to explore the significance of these contradictions. It allows us, for example, to decide whether a text is historical or purely propagandistic or ideological. And in that sense, it still tells us something about the text. You know, sort of like, so the idea is not you bring them into conversation to learn more about, you know, each of the two bodies of evidence, not to disprove or prove one or the other, and therefore sort of like to basically throw it out, you know, sort of like it allows us exactly. to learn more about each body of evidence.
Exactly, and as a great scholar, Roland Devaux, had said, we actually compare and contrast not the Bible with archaeology, but our interpretation of the biblical text with our interpretation of the archaeological evidence. And then it's we go into what Dennis very aptly said, that's how we proceed.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the sort of old idea of having the Bible in your hand and going to look for something,
exactly,
you know, is
definitely
out of the picture.
We have to keep in mind that many of our texts are curated texts. We can call them, you know, they are very well curated, very they are ideological texts, you know, which are sort of like, so we would be naive to assume that they represent like a window, you know, like reality TV, you know, a window into, you know, they're not reality TV. They are not a direct window to ancient life. So this is where archaeology comes in, and it allows us to bridge this gap. You know, we have this curated image, and then we have this is real daily life. And sort of like, and in that sense, it allows us to sort of like appreciate better the literary genre of these texts, what they're trying to do, what they're trying to say, without interpreting them naively as if they are like a direct one-to-one correspondence with what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. And I think at this point, perhaps for our listeners, so that it perhaps comes visually a little bit into the into the creating an image of what you're talking about, perhaps each of you could give us one example of this kind of what you're saying, you know, interpreting and looking at the text and actually matching the two, seeing what you found in one way, what you found in another. Who's going to start? Okay. Rosa Frendo.
Yeah, I'll start with the older period. I'm going to give an example from one of the most, I know it's the most difficult period in ancient Israelite history and study, but it's good to you know, take the bull by the horns. I'm referring to how Israel, ancient Israel, emerged on the scene of history. Now, in the old days, up to about 1960 or so, people used to go with this at least hidden idea. You know, I've got the Bible in one hand, the trowel in the other hand, and I'm going to prove the Bible. So when it came to describing how Israel emerged, then in the Hebrew Bible, there isn't only one voice. There are multiple voices on how Israel appeared on history. But people preferred, for their own reasons, to take the first 12 chapters of Joshua, which reveals Israel entering Canaan like a blitzkrieg, you know, like a lightning war, smashing up everywhere, killing all the Canaanites and gaining the land in 7 days, in a few days. And all. Now, and then they said, look, in archaeology, we think that the entry happened around 1200. That's true. Most scholars agree on that. So they said, right, what did we find in 1200 new in Canaan? We found a type of room called the four-room house, a type of jar called the corundrum jar, and some destruction layers. Right, so the first 12 chapters of Joshua are correct. Israel entered by conquest. What they forgot were two things. One, that there is another version in the Bible itself, which seems to be more realistic. It's in the first chapter of Judges and the first few verses of chapter 2 that the tribes were acting separately from each other, helping each other, yes, but not as a unified whole, and over a long period of time, and largely peacefully, with some skirmishes, but largely peacefully. Only later the wars came. And archaeology since then moved on, and we've discovered at least, in fact, more, but let's say conservative estimate, over 300 unfortified villages in the highlands of Canaan on virgin soil. So there was no military conquest when these were founded. Semi, they came later, some skirmishes and so on, with a few before. And so the picture now is, what do we have here? The material culture remains nearly the same. We now, to put it simply and briefly, believe nowadays that there were discontented Canaanites coming from the coast, where there was a lot of upheaval, climatic and political, into the country. And a small group from outside Egypt came bringing the Yahwistic faith, and they merged with them, and they emerged as a loose confederation of tribes called Israel, which, by the way, is a Canaanite name, Israel. But this small new group from outside, who had a nomadic background, gave the Yahwistic faith to this group, which eventually evolved. So the picture isn't a conquest. It's mainly peaceful, with some military skirmishes, and some other things are there too, but I don't want to take too long. It's a very complicated process. But what I'm saying is, you can't just make a photocopy of one with the other.
And yeah, Mitzi. My example takes us several centuries in the future, so beyond the biblical period, but it's still a question of text and archaeology, and it's about late antiquity and about synagogues, Judaism in late antiquity. And for a long while, scholarship on Judaism in late antiquity was very much based on just the texts. specifically rabbinic literature, because that's the only Jewish literature that survives, or that most Jewish literature is rabbinic in the spirit, to the point that basically if you look at most scholarship before, let's say, the year 2000, the history of Judaism in late antiquity is what one could call rabbinocentric history. You know, a rabbinic history of Judaism, or a history of rabbinic Judaism. And this kind of history was very monolithic. It gave the impression that Judaism in the spirit was monolithic, uniform, that the rabbis were in control, that all Jewish communities across the Galilee, perhaps even other communities in the diaspora, in the Mediterranean, they were all like following the rabbinic interpretation of the law, and there's sort of like the halakha, the what we call the Jewish legal tradition as prescribed by the rabbi. So basically they presented an image of Judaism as rabbinic Judaism. Now recently, in the past two decades or so, archaeology, thanks to archaeology and the excavation of many synagogues dating to late antiquity, we now have a much more nuanced picture of Judaism in late antiquity. Now we have synagogues which include mosaic floors with depictions of figural images portraying biblical episodes, but also incorporating Greco-Roman motifs, Greco-Roman iconography, so on and so forth. And also iconography which seems to reflect certain mystical elements and sort of like mystical interpretations of Jewish tradition. Which are sometimes at odds with rabbinic ideas, with what we know from the rabbinic corpus. So the excavation of these synagogues is allowing us to, first of all, appreciate the pluralism that was Judaism in late antiquity, but also it's giving voice, so to speak, to those other forms of Judaism besides the rabbinic variety or the rabbinic version that were silent up to now, so to speak, because they did not leave text behind. But they left material remains in the form of synagogues, in the form of mosaic floors, in the form of visual iconography. And thanks to that, we are sort of like learning of new Jewish voices from late antiquity, independent of the rabbinic corpus.
In fact, sorry,
you
reminded me of something. When Israel emerged, they proposed Yahwism, and there is one text where Joshua tells people, which God do you want to worship, Yahweh or your gods, the gods of your ancestors? You say, Yahweh. And you get the impression that this is what they did. Whereas archaeology has shown us that for about 600 years, most of the people, not the leaders and the elite, were still worshipping their Canaanite gods and goddesses. And it took about 600 years for that word to become true. And the other thing what I said before, the colored rim jar and the four-room house, archaeologists till the 60s said, we find this mainly in 1200 onwards, so this is an Israelite artifact, right? And so the Israelites came in here. No, because we now know that this existed before the Israelites came and in areas which are not Israelites, and therefore the Israelites preferred it, but it's not that they who got it with them. So the texts have to be nuanced with the archaeological research, and we get a better picture for both, I think.
If I may add I'm involved in a project which is unearthing one of the synagogues I've mentioned. It's the site called Hukok, and also what's interesting about the site and the splendid mosaics that we are finding there is, again, and this takes us back to the Bible. So as I said, many of these mosaics portray biblical scenes, and in some cases, thanks to these mosaics, we're also sort of like learning about how ancient communities interpreted the Bible. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we have a panel which depicts the story of Jonah and the fish, okay, when Jonah was swallowed by the fish, except this panel depicts Jonah being swallowed by a fish who is in turn swallowed by another fish who is in turn swallowed by a third fish. This is not in the biblical text. Why do we have it there? And apparently we are learning from later traditions, from medieval traditions, that there was an interpretation of the original biblical text that because the biblical text switches the grammatical form of fish, dog, and daga, male and masculine and feminine, it uses them interchangeably. But later interpreters saw this switch from masculine to feminine as indicating that Jonah was not being, was swallowed not by a single fish, but by three fish, because you have this switch from masculine to feminine back to masculine. And we learned this from a medieval tradition. Our excavations now show that this tradition was actually already in existence in late antiquity, in the 5th, 6th century AD, sort of like 600 years before the medieval tradition. And now we're also discovering that similar traditions also existed in Islamic texts. So we have sort of like this interplay between the sort of like different biblical interpretations that are sort of like crossing boundaries between Jewish and Muslim communities. And again, this is an excellent example of how archaeology and text, it's not about trying to prove or disprove, it's about how they can enrich each other.
Exactly.
And this is a good example of that.
Yeah. Well, one, if I may, a question about place, because one obviously thinks of biblical archaeology and being in the environs of Israel. But are there other places around the Levant where you've both been, probably? Yeah. I mean, I just... Right.
The whole Near East has to be taken into account for the Hebrew Bible and for the New Testament, even the Roman Mediterranean.
Exactly. In fact, that's one of the problems is that sometimes people look at this in a bubble. It's as if even the discipline itself, biblical studies, Old Testament studies, everything is in a bubble, or Jewish studies, but really...
You need both. For example, Mesopotamia is extremely important.
Yes.
We have king lists and so on, and names of people, we know how they were even pronounced, and so on. So it has to be taken in the context of, I would say, if you include Hebrew Bible and New Testament, then you have to widen the horizons into the ancient Near East, Egypt, and the Roman world.
Yes. In fact, nowadays scholars are moving towards a point where they are arguing, I think convincingly, that we have to envision the world of the ancient Mediterranean and beyond as a form of a globalized world. It's not globalized in this modern sense of globalization, but still, it's a very highly interconnected world, and where you have at least around the Mediterranean, but also the Near East, a common vocab, let's say, like, again, going back to the synagogue, a common visual vocabulary that is then being used and given a twist locally by different communities. So you have similar imagery cropping up across the Mediterranean, but then with a specific local twist. So Jews, like, for example, at our synagogue at Chukok, they are engaging. They are using iconography, including sirens and harpies and Dionysiac imagery, but all in the services of promoting their own version of Judaism. So it is similar but different, and this is again like what we see with globalization, where you have this sort of like tension between the global and the local.
Unity in diversity.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is why you cannot study this world without the larger context.
And the other thing about the text, well, not only the text, I mean, in both cases, in both disciplines, both the archaeology and the textual study, in our case here, the Bible, we have to see the evidence each time on its own merits. And we have to read between the lines. For example, one scholar had once mentioned a very fine example. If a housewife makes the lists, a list of vegetables and fruits she wants to buy and leaves it somewhere and it's dug up, from that list, we can know when she did this. The list wasn't made for that purpose,
exactly.
But we can know about it.
Well, amazingly, the half hour has passed, and I'd like to thank Professor Anthony Frentor and Dr. Dennis Mitzi for being with us and showing us how material culture and biblical text illuminate each other. As always, I encourage our listeners to join me again next week when we shall be tackling another important theme in the field of archaeology. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.